Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Donald Trump this week criticized Jewish Americans who support Democratic candidates. He called such voters very disloyal and triggered a raft of angry responses from Jews and others who call his comments anti-Semitic. The president's remarks came in the wake of another controversy over travel restrictions in Israel for two members of Congress who have been critical of Israeli domestic policy. Today on All Sides with Ann Fisher, political journalist Ken Rudin joins us. He's host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Thank you, Ann. I'd like to see if is Columbus available to be bought. I'd like to purchase the city of Columbus, if that's okay, if I need it.
That's a good question. And that has raised a lot of interesting questions since the president floated that one about purchasing Greenland from the country of Denmark. That's a whole nother thing. There's a lot to talk about, as usual.
There is.
Would you rather talk about Greenland right now?
What? No. Well, you know something. I mean, maybe it's a little sign of levity in a time when things are just so awful around the world and in this country as well. So I'll start wherever you want to start.
All right. So he doubled down on these comments about Jewish voters this week. What do you think his logic is when it comes to calling Democratic, Jewish Americans who vote Democratic disloyal?
Well, there's so many things to say about that. First of all, there's always been this meme or this trope about Jews that they have a dual loyalty to both the United States and Israel.
Catholics used to have the same sort of thing with the
Vatican.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When John F. Kennedy was running in 1960, they were talking about his direct line to the Vatican and whose purpose would he serve, the popes or the American people. Mm-hmm. That seems to have disappeared. The stuff about Jews has not. And it's remarkable because basically he says that if Jewish Americans vote for Democrats, they're disloyal. Now, but who would they be disloyal to? I assume what he meant is that they would be disloyal to Donald Trump and the Republicans, because if you vote for Democrats, you're voting for Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and all other so-called alleged anti-Semitic Democrats who Donald Trump is trying to portray as the Democratic Party.
You know, Democrats, by and large, though, they have as close of a relationship with Israel and so forth as the Republicans do.
Well, it's changing. I mean, the old Democratic Party used to see Israel in a way which is different than a lot of people see Israel today. And of course, Israel is not the same as it was a long time ago. If you think of what's happened since 1967 and the accusations of it being an apartheid state and stuff that's going on with the Palestinians, I mean, there's a lot of younger Jews, younger people are seeing Israel as more of an occupation state, which is putting a lot of controversy in both the American Jewish community and just the country itself writ large. So the view of Israel is not the same as it used to be. And of course, the Democratic Party is less united on this issue than it has ever been before.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, talking national politics with Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Like to hear from our listeners, as always, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, the president has done this before. He did it again in the case of the two freshman members of Congress who were looking to travel to Israel. Is that he got involved with something offshore? He said that they shouldn't be allowed in the country because they had said things against the Israeli state. What about that tradition? It's not a law; it's a tradition, more or less, isn't it?
Well, we're talking about two different things here. There is a tradition that, of course, if the thought of the president of the United States telling another country that they should bar two American citizens from entering their country is almost unheard of. But there is an Israeli law, I think it was passed pretty recently, actually, that says that people coming to the country can be, people who want to come to the country could be barred if they're coming to criticize and talk, you know, talk negatively about the country's policies. So there is that. But more importantly than the law that may be involved in Israel, it's Trump's involvement. Now, Trump says, I didn't say they couldn't do it. Matter of fact, they could do it, but they decided not to do it. They wanted to, like Tlaib's grandmother lives on the in the West Bank. But she was under orders from the Israeli government that, yes, you can visit your grandmother, but not if you're going to continue to call for a boycott. As a matter of fact, both congresswomen this week called for an end of all U.S. aid to Israel, which is not the opinion not only of the American government, but of Congress itself. They are on the outskirts of, of the opinion of what to do about Israel. They, as a matter of fact, Omar herself has, and Tlaib in some respects, have both been accused of saying things that have been interpreted as anti-Semitic when when Omar started talking about they're in it for the Benjamins. In other words, Benjamin Harrison, the money that Jewish voters can get with AIPAC and Israel and things like that. And then talking about dual loyalty. So there has been, there have been some comments made by the two members of Congress that has been seen or at least criticized as anti-Semitic. But for the, having the president talk about basically what he's trying to do is split the Democratic Party by basically labeling the Democratic Party as the party of Omar and Tlaib, and in some respects Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, another member of the squad, and basically telling that, look, this is a left-wing Democratic Party, and if you, obviously the alternative is to vote for me and the Republicans, and that's where that loyalty comment comes in, that if you don't vote for me rather than Democrats, you're being disloyal.
The Republican Party is now being called the party of Trump. Do you think he could level the same kind of damage to the Democrats?
Well, he's trying. He's certainly trying. But there's and certainly this is the party of Trump. I mean, basically, the few Republicans in office who have tried to stand up to the president have gotten tremendous blowback at home. When Tom Tillis, the senator from North Carolina, who's up for re-election next year, suggested that maybe Trump's order, executive order about the border in Mexico may be beyond the pale, he was immediately hit with a right-wing challenge at home, and he's come back into line. When Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator, criticized Donald Trump, immediately his numbers, his Flake's numbers in Arizona went down so low that he was forced to retire. John McCain, of course, is not around anymore. More Bob Corker of Tennessee is not is left the Senate. Mark Sanford, the congressman from South Carolina who criticized Trump, lost his primary. So basically, there's a message to Republicans out there. If you're in office and you want to stay in office, criticizing Donald Trump is not the way to stretch out your political career. And there are a lot of examples to prove it.
As far as, you know, his comment, I mean, do you feel these things, nothing seems to, was it Ronald Reagan was the Teflon president or whatever, but.
Right. Pat Schroeder called him the Teflon
that's
president.
That's right. Pat Schroeder of Colorado. I'm just wondering if that any of this stuff matters going forward, you know,
well, here's the
16,
thing. Here's the
you
thing.
Know, 14 months down the road.
You know, I mean, Ronald Reagan, if you look at his numbers during his first term, like during the recession of 1982, his numbers dropped very, very low. And then as the economy improved, his numbers accelerated to very, very high. And he wound up winning 49 states against Walter Mondale in 1984. But Trump's numbers have not changed as much as is a dedicated segment of the populace that opposes Trump, his support among Republicans has not moved. His numbers about approval ratings are maybe about 40%, 42%, 43%, with opposition in the mid to high 50s. But that hasn't changed in the 2.5 years he's been president. So that's pretty remarkable. He's obviously not trying to extend his support and try to win over centrist voters. What he is definitely trying to do is excite the base, keep the base excited. And you see that with those rallies he has, continual rallies, where basically the script is exactly the same. Blame Obama, blame Hillary Clinton, blame anyone he wants to, and talk about the Socialist Democratic Party. And we'll see if they come out. The question is whether the Democrats come out. Remember, there are a lot of African-American voters, for example, in 2016, who were very excited about Barack Obama, who were less so enthralled with Hillary Clinton and did not come out. I mean, if let's just say, for example, African-Americans in Michigan, it was like 83% for Obama in 2012 and maybe 70-something percent for Hillary Clinton. That drop off, which may not be a lot, probably cost her Michigan and other states like that. So the enthusiasm, what the Democrats need to do is keep the enthusiasm that the Republicans have on their side to come out of to vote against Trump.
And that field is thinning, by the way, as well. Two candidates dropped their bid for the Democratic nomination, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper and Washington Governor Jay Inslee. So what are we down to, like 21 or?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's hardly
every time every time I talk about this, I'm going to get that number down. And I can't keep it track.
Well, it's running out of 24. You're right. Three have dropped out. Congressman Eric Swalwell, John Hickenlooper, and John Inslee, and Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, who dropped out yesterday. John Hickenlooper, by the way, today, who dropped out last week, announced this morning that he's going to run for the Senate, which is what the Democrats wanted all along. That he's going to challenge Cory Gardner, the Republican senator in Colorado. But you still have the next debate is September 12th and maybe the 13th. If you have a large enough field, there's already 10 candidates who have qualified for the September 12th debate. So we're not going to have any shortage of people on the stage, at least in the first debate. You have at least three or four other candidates who are on the cusp of making the qualifications to get in that debate. But you have a bunch of all others, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, like even including Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, Michael Bennett of Colorado. You have a whole bunch of Democrats who are in danger of not making the debate stage. And I think, you know, that if they're not on the debate stage, they might as well give it up because, if you're not seen by millions of people watching the debates, you're going to be ignored and your chances just go down the drain.
I'm going to take a quick call right now. Let's see, Evan and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hello. How are you guys all doing today?
Good.
I was calling to talk about – I'm doing – thank you. I was going to call about the Teflon candidacy of Ronald Reagan and how it compares to Donald Trump. And we're talking about the poll numbers. I don't think the poll numbers matter. I mean, just go back to election night. So the issue is that I think a lot of things that the Democrats are, you know, upset at Trump about are things that his base and Republicans in general don't really care about. I mean, we're looking around. We're seeing pedophile rings. We're seeing, you know, basically horrible anti-Semitic comments by Congress people and things like that. And honestly, you know, you see Trump, and he doesn't put up with it. He points out that Google is basically an extension of the Democrats at this point, and all of these other horrible things. And that's why he's most likely going to be winning 2020.
Ken Rudin.
Well, boy, you know, I mean, look, the fact that I couldn't even make a prediction on the day of the election in 2016 who was going to win because I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I'm certainly not going to make a prediction a year and 3 months out. But having said that, he could very well win. The fact is that his base, I mean, forget about the fact that he's naming conservative judges to the court, as he promised, or tax cuts, as he promised. But the fact that he's talking about women and Muslims and Latinos and Jews and the handicapped, the derogatory comments he makes, the lies, absolute lies he makes when he goes on the stage, he makes up stuff. And the the confusing foreign policy. I mean, attacking, calling the Prime Minister of Denmark a nasty person because she rejected his purchase request for Greenland. It's just beyond them. But you're, but Evan is right in the fact that his supporters don't care. They mm-hmm. they just like him. They like his gumption. They like his call it as it is. The question is, how many of those people are there? If the polls indicate that he has strong support of 42% of the American people, well, that's less than the 46%, 48% that he got running for president in 2016. If it doesn't expand, he's in, you know, it's going to be a tough battle for him. But again, what Evan hasn't mentioned and what we haven't mentioned yet is that the Democrats right. are hardly united right. behind a Democratic candidate. There are a lot of divisions in the Democratic Party, and that plays into it as well.
And even if they do unite against a candidate, is it going to be someone who lights a fire enough to get, get them to turn out at the polls on Election Day, which was Hillary Clinton's problem?
That's a great question. One of the debates besides ideology that's in the Democratic Party right now is, do you want somebody who's true to progressive principles, or do you want somebody who could win? And that may not necessarily be the same person. And herein lies the quandary for the Democrats.
We will continue our conversation with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that podcast on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics today with Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken Rudin, we've been talking about the rest of the Democratic field seeking the Democratic nomination for president. Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's been gaining in recent polls, but she is struggling with the African-American vote. A Fox News survey showed that she has less than 10% of support among African-American voters. I saw another poll that put her at about 8%. Is that possible? Is it humanly possible to win the Democratic nomination with those kind of numbers?
No, but of course, this is August and not, February, where we'll have the Democratic caucuses in Iowa and primaries in New Hampshire and South Carolina, where the black vote is significant. Look, remember, I mean, this is not really comparable. It may be apples and oranges, but when Barack Obama first announced for his candidacy in 2007, the black vote was pretty much united behind Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
When Jesse Jackson announced in 1983, the black vote was united behind Walter Mondale. African-Americans, I mean, it's not reflexive that just because it's a black candidate, that they back a candidate. They have to be wooed like everybody else has to be wooed.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, her natural constituency is not African-American members. You have two blacks already in the race. You have, of course, Kamala Harris, mm-hmm. and you have Cory Booker. Plus, you have Joe Biden, the vice president, the loyal vice president under Barack Obama, who has a strong groundswell of support among black voters. So, look, it is early. Everybody's learning. The campaigning is still going on. There's still more debates, God help us. But you have a long way to go. But again, there are obstacles in her way and Bernie Sanders' way and others who are not doing especially well among black voters. But again, we have a long way to go.
Jerry in Lima, you're on the air. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to let you know that I'm definitely a Trump voter, and I just wanted to give you the perspective. one of the main reasons, not only do I agree with many of the things that Trump's doing, not always his tone, but certainly with many of the things that he's doing, but it's your show, it's the mainstream media, it's the universities, it's a continued attack on him. He's treated so much more critically than the Democrats and the liberals. It just emboldens people. I think people who are so tired of that kind of unfair treatment, I think it's going to go ahead and push them towards Trump.
Hmm. Ken Rudin?
Yeah, I'm glad Jerry called it because, look, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of ideological reasons to support Donald Trump. One, he's done a lot of what he promised. He's running a conservative philosophy, although not on the deficit. The deficit is rising out of control. But he promised tax cuts. He delivered. He promised conservative judges. He's delivered. Mm-hmm. He's promised a tough foreign policy. He's delivered. But at the same time, Jerry, I know that this conversation will never convince you otherwise, but what gets to me about Trump, and I'm saying this not because I'm a Democrat, because I'm not because I'm a liberal, because I'm not, it's the dishonesty and the meanness and the arrogance and the cruelty, the attacks on the press. I mean, other than Stalin, who talks about the enemy of the people? Who talks about, you know, about blacks and Latinos and Muslims? Who wants a ban on people coming into this country because of their ethnicity? So, look, yeah, there are a lot of things I understand about Trump's support. It's the dishonesty. It's the cruelty. It's the lies. It's the made up stuff that drives us crazy. Now, of course, when the media points that out, there are a lot of people who say, well, if the media is attacking him, I'm going to support him. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to give up. You don't have to give up your conservative philosophy to agree that some of the stuff that he's saying is just cruel and wrong and outright lies. And I think that's why the media points it out, not because we're liberal. Look, the media was all over Hillary Clinton with the emails. The media was all over Bill Clinton because of Monica Lewinsky. I think the media likes to go where the story is, but I think it's less about a liberal media and than a media and a you know, we talk about the mainstream programs like this. I think what public radio brings you is both sides, but at the same time, if somebody is lying and being cruel and dishonest and just making stuff up, it's the role of the media to point that out.
Jerry, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is a political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I've got a couple calls about the Democratic field. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Ken. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. So I was calling regarding the enthusiasm gap on the Democrat side, and you all were talking earlier about the struggle between electability and honing to progressive values. And there's another narrative out there that if the Democrats elect or nominate somebody like Joe Biden, a middle-of-the-road safe candidate, that they're not going to drive out the progressive base. So the exact same thing that you all were talking about with Trump and his strategy of not trying to win over voters in the middle and just going for the base. It's my opinion that to go up against a candidate like Donald Trump, the Democrats would be better off to nominate somebody who is a tried and true progressive. And I'm an independent voter who votes tends to vote Democrat.
Okay.
And I'll take your responses off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Ken Rudin.
There are a lot of reasons why Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. Some of it was the fact that she was very establishment. She was not willing to go as far as the Bernie Sanders wing of the party on a lot of issues. But at the same time, I'm not convinced, I don't know, but I'm not convinced that Americans are going to be willing to give up private health insurance. There are 160 million people who have private health insurance. I would think a lot of whom are very happy with it, to lose that and have the Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Medicare for All, or whatever concoction of that whatever iteration of that program is. I'm not sure if everybody wants that. I'm not sure if everybody agrees that people coming into the country illegally should not be criminally charged. I don't know. I mean, Joe Biden said that the other day and it got booed. Basically, Joe Biden's positions on so many of these issues are exactly the way the Democratic Party was under Obama. But I think Chris, you're right. The party has moved to the left, but I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you look at Pete Buttigieg, who has very little qualifications, or at least in office, and yet he's touching a chord because he's less ideological and more common sense. I don't know what wins. Obviously, the Hillary Clinton, did she lose because she was Hillary Clinton? Did she lose because she was a woman? Did she lose because she was establishment? We're going to learn a lot about these candidates during the primaries coming up and the debates coming up. But your guess is as good as mine. I don't know what's going to win in Donald Trump. We've never seen any candidate, for better or worse, as we have in Donald Trump. He's impossible to describe. The people, I talk to people around the world who just roll their eyes and say, how is this possible? But I know how it's possible, because there's a lot of people are tired of politics as usual. And certainly Donald Trump is not that. And so are many Democratic candidates who are not the Joe Biden, greatest hits of the past kind of candidate.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Cynthia and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, good morning, Ann and Ken. Thanks for the show.
You bet.
Disclaimer, I am a progressive, and I'm like Chris, I'm calling about your comment that we have to vote either somebody who's true to their progressive values or somebody who's electable.
But let me just interrupt. No, I'm not saying it has to be either or, but that seems to be a choice within the party. Okay.
Right. Okay.
Sorry.
I believe that somebody who is true to their progressive values will definitely bring out the base. It will create enthusiasm in the party, and I believe that to be a fact. I'm pretty active in a lot of local groups, and I firmly believe that that would happen. To your comment about healthcare, sure, a lot of us have healthcare through employers, but man, I have a $6,000 family deductible. Do you think I think twice about going to the doctor if I feel like I don't really have to? I sure do. Because that's a heck of a lot of money out of my pocket. And I know a lot of people who are in that same situation. It's not our health care, that company that we love, our insurance company that we love. It's being able to have access to good doctors and good medical care.
And affordable, and right.
And affordable, yes. And so that is the bottom line. Not that I love my insurance company. I don't know anybody who loves their insurance company. But that's my two cents. Thank you.
All right, Cynthia.
Before you go, do you have a candidate?
I'm leaning toward Bernie Sanders, yes.
Ken?
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, basically, Bernie Sanders embodies exactly what we're talking about. Not politics as usual. Willing to take risks, certainly. Try something new because look, I agree completely with Cynthia saying. There are people with the current system. It's just costing a fortune. The premiums, deductibles are just out of control, and that's why you have the desire for something beyond Obamacare that Sanders and Warren and Harris and others are offering. I understand that completely.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for your call. I appreciate it. Ken, do you think that then, what have we been talking about? Healthcare. Do you think that's going to be still a major issue going forward?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I think we learned that in 2018, especially when the Republicans were still defending their desire to get rid of Obamacare, get rid of pre-existing conditions, and Republicans were on the defensive about it. And I think a lot of the reasons why Democrats won in so many heretofore Republican districts were that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there is something rotten with the system, healthcare system in this country, and certainly getting rid of pre-existing conditions was the top of the list. So I think Republicans may say immigration. I think Democrats clearly feel that healthcare is the number one issue. And that's why if you're a Democratic candidate and don't have a plan or an opinion of what needs to be done, you're out of luck.
All right. So that had a lot to do with the midterm elections. Healthcare was a big issue there. What did Republicans learn? How will they change? How does their game plan change going forward into 2020?
Well, I noticed that as we got closer to the election of 2018, a lot of Republicans were saying, no, I'm really in favor of pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. I'm really in favor of gun restrictions. I'm really in favor of background checks. But that's exactly what Trump did. Speaking of background checks and guns, that's exactly what Trump did in the aftermath of El Paso and Dayton. As he did with Parkland last year, President Trump said, what we need is more and more background checks. I think that is a key issue, and I will push for it. And as he did last year after Parkland, he met with Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, and he said, you know something? I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment, and you know what? I've given this a lot of thought. We have plenty of background checks. So again, the urgency, the shock, the horror, the absolute horror of what happens with a gun incidents like El Paso and Dayton. Everybody gets riled up. The president and the Republicans say, yeah, I think we could do something. A week or two goes by, a month goes by, and it's gone. Mm-hmm. And President Trump says, never mind. And the country, again, accepts it until the next horror. Look, if nothing was done after Sandy Hook, where 20 or so, 23 second and third graders were gunned down, then I don't know if this country will ever support it. And that's just shocking to me. Shocking.
We're going to take a break, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the gun control issues. President Trump is starting to confuse the public on his stances on gun control. Talk about that and more with my guest, Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. You can check out the podcast. Go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you haven't already. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking national politics today with Ken Rudin, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what about the gun control, Ken? I mean, do you think gun control is going to be, will it take yet another tragedy to put it on the roster for the 2020 election cycle?
Well, it's not going to go away from the cycle. Obviously, in a lot of the Trump districts that Democrats won in 2018, I don't think guns will be as big an issue as it will be in the more urban areas, or at least where there have been more and more instances of gun violence. That's not going to go away. But the fact is that it's like Parkland, it's like San Bernardino, it's like Orlando, it's like Aurora, it's like everything else that it happens. Everybody gets so upset. We need new gun laws, and everybody, Mitch McConnell says, I'll think about it. And then, of course, he thinks about it for 15 minutes, and Trump thinks about it for 15 minutes, and then it goes away. Now, I don't know what the answer is. I don't mm-hmm. know if background checks are the answer. I don't know if banning assault weapons are the answer, but the fact is, we are losing so many people, so many children, so many young people to gun violence every day that try something. I mean, if it doesn't work, okay, it didn't work, but try something as opposed to thoughts and prayers are great, but for what? I mean, I as I wrote on Facebook, I said, My thoughts and prayers go out to people who think that thoughts and prayers are going to change something. Mm-hmm. They won't. Action is going to have to take place, and right now it just doesn't. I mean, even after Sandy Hook, where those young children were killed, and it was a Democratic Senate, Dianne Feinstein put up offered a bill banning assault weapons. Putting in more registration background checks. Mm-hmm. And it failed in the Democratic Senate. There were 55 Democrats in the Senate in 2013, and it got 40 votes. So it's not, I'm not blaming Republicans. I'm blaming just by its nature, inaction in Congress, and nothing gets done. And try something other than thoughts and prayers.
Let's see. Susan in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling about the issue of abortion. I wonder how the Democrats are worried that they'd be too liberal on health care, and nobody talks about their extreme embrace of abortion in all cases. And they've completely dismissed a whole group of people who support their views on many issues like health care and workers' rights, mm-hmm. but they've just completely out of hand dismissed any kinds of restrictions on abortion.
Well, wait a minute. I don't think that's true. I mean, I know in Ohio it certainly isn't. There's lots of Democrats who vote for different kinds of restrictions on abortions. Ken Rudin, is that part of the Democratic platform at this point? No restrictions?
Well, what Susan is saying is a talking point that we've heard from the pro-life community before, that Democrats are the party on abortion on demand. And certainly the Democratic Party is seen as more abortion rights than the Republicans. That is true. But Ann, you're absolutely right. There are different grades of restrictions. There are a lot of Democrats who oppose what we call as partial birth abortion or late term abortions. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that abortion, like guns, is a very divisive issue in the country. And I suspect that, like with guns, I think people who are opposed to abortion are more likely to come out in larger numbers than people who support abortion rights. That's not my opinion. I think that's what polls right. indicate. Same with guns. I think people who are against gun restrictions will come out more heavily than people who want more restrictions on guns. But having said that, look, I mean, you know, it was interesting when there was an election for mayor of Omaha a year or two ago, if memory serves. And Bernie Sanders came into Omaha and backed a Democratic candidate that was pro-life, but he was liberal on social issues. And Bernie Sanders got hell over this. He said, how do you back somebody who's against, you know, the liberal abortion plan? So the Democrats are also split on it as well. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, and again, anyway, what Susan is saying, I don't think the Democrats are the abortion at any cost party, but certainly that is an issue that comes up in every election, at least since right. the Roe decision of 73.
Absolutely. Susan, thank you so much for your call. Jim in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Ken, Ann, it's a great show today. First of all, disclaimer, I had a political science professor years ago, who used to say, as far as politics, there's far left, far right, and the far out. So I think I fall in the far out category now. But
okay.
my question is, I've been reading a lot about voter suppression, not only in Ohio, but in some states where college students will have to get an in-state driver's license to be able to vote. And, of course, people being struck off the rolls in the South. And I was just wondering what you think that might have as far as an impact on voter turnout. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
Oh, man, I love this. Far out, Jim. No, I really appreciate Jim's. Everybody has an opinion about who everybody else, what the politics of everybody else. People can call me a liberal or a conservative or whatever, but one thing I definitely have a view about is about the access to voting. And what Jim is saying about voter suppression is real. The fact is that it's not a coincidence that in many many states that have Republican legislatures, especially North states like North Carolina, but there are others, and Texas, where there are restrictions. There are fewer voting machines in poor and Latino and Black communities. There are shorter hours. They're cutting early voting systems. You have to show ID. I mean, look, I think, you know, look, there's always the talk about illegal voters, but for all what Donald Trump has talked about with people voting illegally, the instances of illegal voters is so rare. But what's not rare is the fact that many people are denied votes if their handwriting looks suspicious, if they move and forget to tell people. There are a lot of reasons, a lot of instances where people who may vote against the party in power are stricken from the voting. Look, in Ohio, if you didn't vote, don't they have a law that if you skipped an election or two, you're wiped out off the voting rolls? Isn't that a law in Ohio?
There is a purge process depending on your frequency of voting. And there's a debate going on here right now about what to do about that. And some people are asking the Secretary of State to delay the purge process this time.
But the fact is, as we saw in Georgia, North Carolina, there are a lot of instances where people of color, senior citizens are just stricken, or there's restrictions on their ability to get to the polls. And that's, you know, winning is fine, but winning fairly is more important.
Thanks for that call. Let's see. Let's go to Tim in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Ken. I am distressed, I guess, would be put it mildly, that climate change and the environment are not more of an issue in this upcoming election. I know that the governor of Washington State has withdrawn his run, and he was primarily interested, apparently, in climate change. I'm curious, and also I understand that the chairman of the Democratic National Committee does not want to allow a debate on one issue like the environment, but I'm concerned that this is not being talked about more, and I just wonder what your perspective is on this. Shouldn't this be, it's an issue that affects everything else that we do on this planet, and I just wonder what your position is on not talking about it more.
Ken Rudin.
Yeah, I think it was Bernie Sanders who said in 2016 that it's the number one civil rights issue in the world. The fact is, ignoring what's happening to this planet, what's happening to the climate is just we're destroying ourselves. We're destroying our planet. We're destroying the future for our children, grandchildren, and their children. It's unbelievable. I mean, Jay Inslee was a one-issue candidate, and to his credit, he brought up issues that other candidates were not bringing up. But the fact is that it is significant, and when you have a president pulling out of, first of all, denying that exists, questioning whether it exists, questioning what kind of science we're following, and taking us out of climate deals with the rest of the world. I think there are three countries now who are not part of that climate change summit. It's just remarkable, and it's frightening. But you know something, if people say, well, it's going to happen in 50 years or 100 years, it's hard to get people excited or interested because it doesn't happen today or tomorrow. And that's unfortunate and short-sighted and very frightening, because I agree it is perhaps the number one issue in the world, let alone the country.
Thank you, Tim, for that call. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I am curious about why the phrase well-regulated militia is completely ignored in all the discussion of the Second Amendment. I mean, the situation when the Second Amendment was written was totally different, with like muskets that you might be able to fire three rounds a minute compared to what current military weapons are. And I don't understand why well-regulated militia is completely ignored. I mean, one would think from my reading of it is if you're a member of a militia, you can have a military weapon. And none of these people, obviously, are members of well-regulated militias. So why are they allowed to have the military-grade weapons?
Well, for a while they weren't. Ken Rudin?
Well, you know the old expression, if you outlaw muskets, only outlaws will have muskets. Yeah, that's an old expression. But, you know, you're absolutely right. Look, I'm not trying to rewrite the Second Amendment. And the Second Amendment means one thing for hunters and the ability to have a gun to somebody else who buys a semi-automatic weapon. And as we saw in Las Vegas, kills 49 people or 63 people or whatever. They just random shooting. Without getting into the definition of the Second Amendment, and for all the people who say, well, Obama will confiscate our guns, Hillary Clinton will confiscate our guns, the fact is that there are some weapons that just don't need to be sold so easily. I mean, we had an assault weapons ban that was passed in 1994. Mm-hmm. It cost many Republicans not only control of the Congress, but it could cost them a lot of their seats. It expired after 2004, and every effort to put it back in Congress, as Democratic and Republican mm-hmm. Congresses, have just ignored it. So forget about what about the militia and what it was like in the 1700s. The fact is that the Second Amendment is being used by so many people to allow insane amount of guns, insane amount of assault-type weapons that are just too easily available.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. We think we have time for just a couple more.
Nobody cares about Greenland.
I know we never got to Greenland.
it is the number one issue in this country.
Ashley in Cleveland, you're a Democrat. You're millennial, but you're frustrated. What's going on?
Well, I just feel like, and love the show, by the way,
that
I want to vote Democrat, and I will vote blue, but you know, like you had said before, it's sort of get on the Trump train if you're a Republican or get off the train. Well, the Democrats just don't have an identity in my mind. Like a ton of our friends are all Democrats, but they all are different Democrats. You know, we have the far left or the establishment. And I feel like there's no true identity and path for a Democrat to vote moving forward. Like they don't even know who they are and they're sort of cannibalizing each other.
Hmm. Ken Rudin.
Well, I agree with that part completely. I mean, the fact is, in the last debate, we heard so much criticism of Barack Obama, who's the most popular Democrat in the country, and yet they were saying, well, you know, he sent those drones out and he deported a lot of people. I'm not dismissing criticism of Obama, but it seems like the Democratic Party just searching for an issue to define themselves. And you're right, they are not doing a clear. A successful effort. But again, as I said, it is August. It is not February where the primaries and caucuses start. It's not July where the conventions will be. And it's certainly not in November. So the Democrats do have a long way to make amends and get their act together. But I mean, things are strange. Look, I mean, I saw a poll the other day that in January of 1972, George McGovern had 3% of the poll of the support in the Democratic process, and he wound up winning the Democratic nomination that year. Mm-hmm. So things do change. Things will start to crystallize. But again, I think this is a very important issue, that if the Democrats are all over the place, they're battling each other, they're eating their own, mm-hmm. Donald Trump and the millions of dollars on his behalf could just be sitting back and saying, look, you know, go for it. Keep doing it because it's only going to help me. Democrats will get their act together, one assumes, and there is still plenty of time. But let's see what happens in the next debate, September 12th, if this cannibalism continues.
Hmm. Time for one more call, and that's Robbie in Columbus. Robbie, we're running out of time, so quickly, please.
I just wanted to say that when we talk about electability, that Democrats need to worry less about the popular vote, but more about the Electoral College.
Ken Rudin.
Well, that's important to note, to point out that two of the last three presidents, George W. Bush and Donald Trump, had fewer votes than their Democratic opponent, but won the Democratic the nomination. Obviously, there are about a half a dozen states: Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida. That will determine the next election, and Democrats may learn what Donald Trump learned, that you don't have to be the winner in 50 states. Mm-hmm. You have to be the winner in those key battleground states that will determine the next president.
And show up in Wisconsin.
Exactly, where Hillary did not do right now.
Right. Thanks a lot for all the calls today. We appreciate it. Any parting thoughts for this week? What are you looking at, Ken? Are you looking at Greenland?
Well, Greenland is now, wait, is that the icy country? Is that the green country? Is that Iceland? I'm confused about that.
Yeah.
Look, obviously, I'm going to watch what's going on when Congress comes back, whether the Congress will pick up on guns, as Mitch McConnell has hinted. I question whether that'll happen or not. And, of course, I'd like to see the battle to see who makes it, what Democrats make it to the September 12th debate stage. Because if more and more are being left out, you're going to see more people like Jake Inslee dropping out of the race.
Ken Rudin, thank you so much for your time. Always appreciate hearing from you.
I love it, Ann. Thank you so much. And remember Greenland.
Remember Greenland. Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. Sorry I couldn't get to all those calls today, but thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.